In late August 1978, the world awaited news from the Sistine Chapel. There, 111 cardinals were ready to vote for the next pope.
This meeting was shrouded in complete secrecy, but here was one main rumor that circulated about the process. As the story goes, Cardinal Jaime Sin from the Philippines believed 65-year-old Italian Cardinal Albino Luciani was the top choice. At one point, Sin even assured Luciani, saying, quote, "You will be the new pope."
And Sin apparently wasn't the only one. Many of his colleagues seemed to agree. After four voting rounds, Luciani amassed an overwhelming majority, about 90 out of 111 votes. The cardinals had made their choice. Albino Luciani was the new pope.
But as they celebrated, Luciani didn't appear happy. Instead, he seemed overwhelmed. When asked if he formally accepted the position, he hesitated before agreeing. Luciani reluctantly named himself Pope John Paul I.
According to the rumor, soon after the election, Jaime Sin visited the new pontiff. The Holy Father supposedly admitted to him, "You are a prophet, but my reign will be a short one."
Whether or not this tale was true, it made a bold but correct prediction. 33 days later, his reign and his life were cut short when Pope John Paul I died under the most mysterious circumstances. Welcome to Conspiracy Theories, a Spotify original from Parcast. Every Monday and Wednesday, we dig into the complicated stories behind the world's most controversial events and search for the truth. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Molly Brandenburg.
And neither of us are conspiracy theorists.
But we are open-minded, skeptical, and curious. Don't get us wrong. Sometimes the official version is the truth.
But sometimes it's not.
You can find episodes of Conspiracy Theories and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
This is our one-part episode on the mysterious death of Pope John Paul I. He died only 33 days into his papacy, leading many to believe foul play was involved.
Today, we'll talk about the Pope's seemingly conventional ascent to become the Catholic Church's supreme pontiff.
Then we'll examine one main theory behind his sudden passing. Italian banker and fraudster Roberto Calvi, along with the mafia and an Italian secret society, all conspired to kill the Pope.
We have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Hi, I'm Blair.
Want to hear something scary?
Join me as I read the creepiest urban legends, folk tales, and ghost stories that I learn on my travels around the world and that we receive from listeners like you. But only if you think you can handle it. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time. Sweet screams.
During his reign, Pope John Paul I earned the nickname the Smiling Pope because of his cheerful demeanor, but his sudden death was anything but a happy matter.
Unfortunately, most memories of him are entwined with how he died and the puzzling conspiracies surrounding it.
But before getting into that, we think it's worth examining the Pope's peaceful early days first.
Albino Luciani was born on October 17, 1912. His mother Bortola's labor had been long and difficult, and she worried her son wouldn't survive.
It's unclear if Luciani was ill after his birth, or, like any new mother, Bortola was simply anxious about her son's future well-being. But as a devout Roman Catholic, she had the baby baptized right away. This way, if the boy did die, he'd ascend to heaven, according to the ideals of Catholicism.
Fortunately, Luciani grew up to be a healthy kid in Canale di Gordo, a small village in the Italian Alps. His family, which consisted of Bortola, his father Giovanni, and his six siblings, resided in a converted hay barn.
Luciani's parents led very different lives, which resulted in their opposing religious philosophies. Bortola took care of Luciani and the other children and loved to attend church.
Meanwhile, his father, Giovanni, traveled around Europe looking for odd jobs as a bricklayer. Through his long trips, he became interested in socialism, an ideology that sometimes embraced atheism.
One local priest hoped Bortola's faith could help bring her husband back to the church. But over the years, Giovanni held firm to his views, creating a further divide in the family.
Likely as a way to escape the tension in the household, Luciani developed a love for reading. He gravitated towards books that reflected his impoverished childhood.
He enjoyed Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol because the author relayed the perspective of the lower class. He also read Carlo Collodi's The Adventures of Pinocchio, seemingly because he saw himself in the wooden boy and his meager surroundings.
From a very young age, these books gave Luciani the desire to help the poor. And in 1922, 10-year-old Luciani discovered a career path that would allow him to do so.
That year, during the observance of Lent, the village had a visitor, a friar from a devout Catholic group called the Capuchin Franciscans. They lived a lot like monks and traveled to poor areas to help feed and care for those living below the poverty line.
Luciani watched in amazement as the friar preached the Lenten sermons to the community. It was at that moment he decided he wanted to be a man of God. Or more specifically, he wanted to become a priest.
Many Catholics in the priesthood believed the decision to join was a special calling from God. So when Luciani ran home to tell his mother, she was more than supportive. She suggested he attend a minor seminary, a boarding school for boys aspiring to become priests.
There was only one problem. Luciani needed his atheist father's approval to do so. So he wrote Giovanni a letter and sent it off to his temporary home in France as he waited with bated breath.
A few weeks later, he received a response from Giovanni with shockingly good news. He granted permission for his son to attend seminary under one condition. As the story goes, he wrote, quote, "I hope that when you become a priest, you will be on the side of the workers, for Christ himself would have been on their side."
Before long, Luciani was deeply immersed in his studies and on his way to joining the priesthood. He earned a reputation for being a well-liked, modest man. Even the church's leadership noticed this, which helped him ascend the ranks quickly.
By 1958, Pope John XXIII ordained 46-year-old Luciani as the Bishop of Vittorio Veneto, a region located 30 miles from his hometown. There, he led the Northern Italian Diocese, or Catholic District.
His work seemed to impress the next pontiff, Pope Paul VI. So when the Patriarch of Venice died in 1969, the Pope called on Luciani to replace him.
Patriarchs are a special type of archbishop, handpicked by the Pope. The Patriarch of Venice, in particular, was in charge of 9 dioceses in northwestern Italy, including Vittorio Veneto.
In other words, this was a massive promotion, kind of like going from a store manager to a regional manager.
Naturally, Luciani accepted the offer, and on December 15, 1969, he officially stepped into the role.
It's said that Luciani's bishops were loyal and enjoyed working with him. Together, they collaborated on humanitarian work, which benefited many of the locals, especially the underprivileged.
They relied on funds from the Catholic Bank of Veneto to support the diocese. Clergy even called Veneto the priest's bank because the financial institution did them many favors.
But this wasn't just out of the goodness of their hearts. Veneto was close to the Vatican's personal bank, the Institute for the Works of Religion, which held a majority share in the Veneto Bank.
In mid-1972, the Catholic Bank of Veneto became a special focus for Luciani, all because the Vatican Bank's president, American Bishop Paul Marcinkus, sold a majority of their shares in the Veneto Bank to someone else.
And the new owner was not a saintly man. He was a financial mogul named Roberto Calvi.
Calvi was the general manager of Italy's biggest private bank, Banco Ambrosiano. He was a wealthy loaner who was extremely private about his life and his business dealings.
Now, with the Veneto shares in his hands, the men of God would financially be at his whim.
Needless to say, the Venetian priests and bishops were extremely upset. Without the backing of the Institute for the Works of Religion, the bank could hinder the clergy's religious work. They had to do something.
They hoped Pope Paul VI would fire Marcinkus for selling off the Veneto shares, but they couldn't just march into the Vatican and make those demands. They needed to abide by the Catholic hierarchy. The only person who seemingly could communicate that to the pontiff was their archbishop and patriarch, Albino Luciani.
So, one day in 1972, the region's bishop spoke to Luciani at his office in Venice's St. Mark's Square, laying out their demands. And like a good leader, Luciani did his best to calm the bishops. He promised them he'd investigate the matter further. Their grievances would be addressed.
But what Luciani discovered may have marked this well-meaning innocent man for death.
Coming up, Albino Luciani learns startling rumors about the Vatican.
Greed, revenge, lust. Murder investigations often pinpoint why someone has been killed, but not necessarily who did the killing.
Every Tuesday on Unsolved Murders, meet the victims, suspects, and investigators of the most notorious criminal cases in history.
Part dramatic podcast, part old-time radio show, Unsolved Murders transports you to the scene of a crime, its ensuing investigation, and every attempt to solve the case.
You'll soon discover that the murder isn't always the most shocking part of the story. Follow the Spotify original from Parcast, Unsolved Murders. Listen free only on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now back to the story.
In mid-1972, Archbishop Albino Luciani, the Patriarch of Venice, looked into a local bank scandal for his diocese. He needed to find out more about the partnership between the two men involved, the Vatican Bank president, Bishop Paul Marcinkus, and financial mogul Roberto Calvi.
Luciani learned that Pope Paul VI was very close to Marcinkus. The Holy Father had been loyal to him ever since the bishop saved him from a knife attack in the Philippines 2 years prior.
So Luciani couldn't just ask him to fire Marcinkus over the Calvi sale simply because it made his bishops angry. He needed to find evidence of a real conspiracy.
According to author David Yallop, he began by visiting his good friend, Bishop Giovanni Benelli, in Rome. Benelli was a Secretariat of State assistant who was known for his wit and sharpness. Close to the inner workings of the Holy See, Benelli was also privy to many of the Pope's secrets, which he reportedly had no problem spilling under the right circumstances.
Over coffee one day, Luciani asked Benelli if he knew why the Vatican had sold off the Veneto shares, and to Roberto Calvi no less. Benelli was quick to admit he did.
As Yallop reported, the bishop claimed the Catholic Bank of Veneto's sale was part of a scheme coordinated by Calvi and Marcinkus.
Calvi supposedly paid Marcinkus around $45 million for those Veneto bank shares, which allegedly helped line his own pockets. It's not entirely clear why Calvi wanted the shares, but his main goal always seemed to be making more money for himself.
In another, seemingly separate deal, the Vatican Bank purchased shares of Banco Ambrosiano, Calvi's own bank. Officially, the Vatican owned 1.8%, but authorities later found it may have been much more.
A Vatican radio director named Father Francisco Ferrucci believed Marcinkus wasn't the only one involved in these backdoor deals. Pope Paul VI may have also known about this scheme. But thanks to the Vatican Bank's ultra-secrecy, there was no evidence to prove any of these claims.
According to Yallop, this revelation baffled Luciani. He returned to Venice feeling disappointed and told his bishops there was nothing he could do to fix the situation, especially if the Pope himself was somehow entangled in the mess.
Luciani had no choice but to put the whole issue behind him. Rumors spread that he held a grudge against Marcinkus, but years later, even Marcinkus himself denied this.
So Luciani continued his work for the diocese and beyond. In June of 1972, at the annual Italian Bishops' Conference, he was elected vice president of the group. Then, on September 16th of that year, Luciani hosted a very important visitor in Venice, Pope Paul VI.
The pontiff even stayed with Luciani, and the two led Mass together. In press photos of the historic event, Pope Paul VI is seen gesturing to the crowd with his arms outstretched. Luciani, however, is looking down and away from the crowd, as if he felt uncomfortable in the spotlight, or maybe being within the Pope's presence.
It's unclear what the Pope and Patriarch discussed during that visit, or if Calvi's banking scheme ever came up at all. Either way, Luciani seemed to move on, and soon moved up in the Catholic Church.
6 months later, in March 1973, the Pope offered 60-year-old Luciani the role of cardinal. In Catholicism, the Pope chooses cardinals to assist him, but they're also responsible for electing new pontiffs. He, of course, accepted.
With his newly minted title, Luciani supposedly entertained another familiar guest in Venice that May, Secretariat of State Assistant Bishop Giovanni Benelli. This time, Luciani didn't pry any further into the Vatican's affairs. But still, according to Yallop, Benelli spilled more secrets.
On this occasion, Benelli talked about another financial scandal, one that, again, may have involved Bishop Paul Marcinkus. The story went something like this.
Back in the United States, FBI officials specializing in organized crime and racketeering had paid a visit to Marcinkus's office. They were investigating $14.5 million worth of counterfeit bonds that had been produced by the New York Mafia and delivered to Rome. They were afraid their final destination might be the Vatican.
And they believed Marcinkus, still head of the Vatican Bank, allegedly had something to do with it.
Both Marcinkus and the Vatican Bank operated under tight secrecy, so it was hard to infiltrate and gather any documents. Eventually, the U.S. Justice Department determined there wasn't enough evidence to charge him or anyone else with the crime. They had to put the case to bed. But everything changed 5 years later in the summer of 1978.
On August 6th, 80-year-old Pope Paul VI died of complications from a heart attack. A few weeks later, on August 26th, the voting body of Catholic cardinals assembled to vote for the next pope. This gathering is referred to as the Papal Conclave, and the process is veiled in complete secrecy. But we do know a few things.
According to the Wall Street Journal, cardinals couldn't campaign to become pope. Instead, other cardinals in the conclave discussed and voted until a two-thirds majority was reached.
The papal conclave considered several candidates to take the role of pope, including the gossiping Benelli, who'd recently been promoted to cardinal. As Pope Paul VI's protege and close friend, he seemed like a natural choice.
But there was just one problem. At 57 years old, many considered Benelli too young to become pontiff. Historically, most popes were age 60 and above.
So the papal conclave instead chose between 65-year-old Luciani and four other sexagenarians. In the first round, the cardinals split their votes evenly between the five candidates. But by round three, Luciani was the clear frontrunner.
According to Time magazine, the cardinals wanted to elect a humble man who got along with everyone. Luciani best fit that description.
On the first day of the papal conclave, he won the fourth and final round with roughly 90 out of 111 votes. Luciani was stunned. The cardinals had chosen him as the new pope. When an official asked if he accepted the honor, Luciani sat in silence, tense and hesitating.
Finally, he accepted and said, quote, "May God forgive you for what you have done in my regard." It's not entirely clear what Luciani meant by that.
But maybe he knew something everyone else didn't.
Coming up, Pope John Paul I's unexpected death. Now, back to the story.
On August 26, 1978, the papal conclave elected 65-year-old Albino Luciani as the new pope.
He chose the name Pope John Paul I in honor of the two Holy Fathers who helped him ascend the Church's ranks, Popes John XXIII and Paul VI.
That same day, the Vatican announced Luciani's papacy and his new name to the crowd outside in St. Peter's Square. Everyone cheered as they welcomed the new pontiff.
Unlike many of his predecessors, Pope John Paul I retained his modest and humble nature even as the head of the Catholic Church. Instead of a traditional coronation ceremony, he held an inauguration, similar to American presidents.
He didn't have time for glamorous perks. As the Catholic Church's supreme pontiff, Pope John Paul I was now the leader of Vatican City, which is technically a small country of its own, which meant he could make all the personnel changes he wanted. That included replacing the Vatican Bank president.
But first, Pope John Paul I concerned himself with helping the world at large. On Italian radio, he announced his six-point plan for the Vatican. It included promoting church unity, preaching the gospel, revising some laws, and helping the poor. Unfortunately, he didn't get very far into his agenda.
On Thursday, September 28, 1978, the Pope woke to a typical day. He prayed and led Mass in the morning. Then he retired to his apartment for the remainder of the afternoon.
The facts after this are fuzzy, but here's what we know for sure. Around 7 p.m., the Pope appeared to have chest pains, but didn't want to call a doctor. Instead, he had a few meetings, ate dinner, and went to his bedroom around 9:30 p.m.
The next morning at 5:10 a.m., the Vatican nuns left the pontiff's coffee outside his apartment, per usual, only he never came out to drink it.
They knew something was amiss. According to Stefania Falasca, vice president of the John Paul I Vatican Foundation, a sister Vincenza knocked on his bedroom door, but there was no answer. She then sent for help.
However, there's conflicting information that comes from the Vatican. They publicly claim the pontiff's secretary, John McGee, went into the room that morning and made the discovery himself.
Whoever it was, they found Pope John Paul I sitting up in bed with his eyes closed. At first, it looked like he'd fallen asleep reading, but when they touched his hands, they were ice cold. They rushed to inform the senior staff around 5:25 a.m.
Later that day, Maggie announced to the world that Pope John Paul I was dead. His reign had only lasted 33 days.
The Vatican Health Service's Dr. Renato Buzzanetti later estimated the Pope's death was due to a heart attack, but many Italians doubted the fact that he died of natural causes.
Instead, they felt he might have known too much and was therefore a victim of foul play.
Which brings us to our one and only conspiracy theory. Marcinkus, Calvi, an Italian secret society, and the Mafia all conspired to kill Pope John Paul I. But before we dive in, it's important to understand the historical climate that allowed this theory to form.
Throughout the 1970s, tensions between the far left and the far right political factions in Italy escalated into terrorism. It was a tumultuous period Italians call Anni di Piombo, or the Years of Lead.
Each side of this political movement resorted to violence, bombing trains and banks, sometimes even killing officials in broad daylight. In March of 1978, a neo-fascist group kidnapped and murdered former Prime Minister Aldo Moro in cold blood.
Afterwards, Italy was abuzz with conspiracies about Aldo Moro's murder. Since politics and religion were deeply intertwined, the same thing happened when Pope John Paul I died in September of that year. Italians questioned everything and suspected foul play was involved.
It didn't help that there were so many discrepancies in the story, specifically pertaining to who found Pope John Paul I the morning after he died.
Plus, an autopsy was never performed to prove he died of a heart attack. According to Falasca's book, the Vatican doctors didn't see the need. They were adamant he died of natural causes.
Then, in 1978, another scandal made headlines. Banco Ambrosiano's top shareholder, the Bank of Italy, published a report that Ambrosiano was headed for a crash due to mismanagement and corruption.
The police were now looking closely at the bank's owner, Roberto Calvi. In 1981, authorities found evidence of his financial schemes and convicted him of illegal currency dealings. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison, but he appealed it and eventually got released while waiting for a new trial.
Except Calvi wasn't out of the woods yet. His investors soon learned that Banco Ambrosiano had more debts than it could pay for. It resulted in an even bigger scandal that implicated the Vatican and tangentially involved Pope John Paul I.
In June of 1982, Banco Ambrosiano finally collapsed with over $1.4 billion in debt, and Calvi had no way to pay it back. The next day, Calvi was discovered hanging from scaffolding, with pieces of bricks and an assortment of national currencies in his pocket. The authorities said he died by suicide, but many believed Calvi had been murdered.
Calvi was notorious for his shady dealings, But one of the biggest was the deal he struck with the Vatican Bank president, Paul Marcinkus. Marcinkus was on Banco Ambrosiano's board of overseas operations.
His job description wasn't entirely clear, but through it, Marcinkus and Calvi became close personal friends. They supposedly even took a lavish vacation together to the Bahamas.
After which, Marcinkus seemed to develop a matching desire to make as much money as possible.
Apparently, their partnership was the reason why the Vatican bought a small portion of Calvi's bank to begin with. Only Calvi never told the Vatican Bank that he was taking their money to lend to holding companies in Latin America and the Caribbean. Supposedly, he felt this was the way to increase Banco Ambrosiano's stock price, but it failed.
Because Calvi was so shady and guarded, it's hard to say exactly how his machinations worked. We aren't even sure how much Vatican funds were tied up in this scheme, since Calvi made the money untraceable. However, Marcinkus denied he ever knew about the company's establishment.
But this got people wondering, how deep did Calvi's scheming go? And who else got caught in the crosshairs? Among those questioning was author David Yalop.
Yalop was a true crime writer who seemed to have an obsession with the Vatican. In 1984, he alleged Pope John Paul I was killed in his book, In God's Name, An Investigation into the Murder of Pope John Paul I. Naturally, it stirred up controversy, and the book ended up on the New York Times bestseller list for 15 straight weeks.
Yalop claimed that in the 1960s, as Pope John Paul I was climbing the ranks of the Catholic Church, Roberto Calvi was joining an Italian secret society called Propaganda Due, or P2.
P2 was an extremely clandestine faction of Italian Freemasons. Supposedly, they were staunch, far right-wing believers who wanted to make Italy fascist again. During the years of lead, the group organized terrorist bombings and was involved in many political scandals.
P2's list of members was secret, but Yalop believed that Roberto Calvi, as well as another banker named Michele Sindona, were among its members.
Together, the two magnates strategized to make as much money as possible through shady deals. Yalop claimed they made illegal deposits, created fake foreign companies, and regularly manipulated the Italian stock market.
But their scheme allegedly reached new heights in 1971. That year, Pope Paul VI appointed American Bishop Paul Marcinkus as president of the Vatican Bank, and Sindona happened to be close friends with Marcinkus.
Yalop claims Sindona introduced Marcinkus to Calvi in a meeting later that year, and Marcinkus agreed to participate in their corrupt financial enterprises, especially if it would financially benefit him as well.
Before long, the Vatican Bank purchased several shares of Banco Ambrosiano. Now, thanks to Marcinkus, the Vatican had connections to other questionable groups as well, such as P2 and the American Mafia, who ran the counterfeit bond scheme we mentioned earlier.
But these men weren't untouchable. In 1972, the Patriarch of Venice, Albino Luciani, learned about the shady banking deal at his diocese's local bank. According to Yalop, Marcinkus, Calvi, and Sindona believed Luciani would seek revenge against them one day. And that moment seemed to come 8 years later, when Luciani became Pope John Paul I.
According to Yalop, Marcinkus thought the new pope was suspicious of him, and if he lost his powerful position as Vatican Bank president, he'd lose access to the pope's finances, which were crucial to Calvi's schemes and his efforts to line his own pockets.
But if the Pope died, Marcinkus could keep his job and Calvi and Sindona's schemes could continue.
Which is why Yalop concluded one of these men could have killed the Pope with poison.
Yalop suggested this would have been quite easy. He believed Vatican security wasn't well guarded, meaning any of these men could have gotten in. In fact, Yallop even tested this theory himself.
He claimed that one evening, he breached the walls of the Vatican deliberately, carrying a suitcase that looked like a bomb. Apparently, he made it past the perimeter without anyone noticing him.
But there were many flaws in the rest of Yallop's so-called investigation. He lacked specificity when it came to fleshing out the facts. And in a review, New York Times journalist Paul Hoffman pointed out that Yallop's sources were either nameless or dead.
And as we just heard, he had rather unconventional methods for researching his story.
That's because he wasn't a traditional investigative journalist. He was a writer for British TV shows, like the BBC soap opera EastEnders. And he was later fired from the TV series for pitching egregiously violent storylines.
His work even seemed to annoy the Vatican itself. According to the New York Times, the Vatican said, quote, "It is shocking and deplorable that anyone could so much as think, let alone publish, theories of this kind."
5 years later, in 1989, an award-winning journalist named John Cornwell published a book called A Thief in the Night, Life and Death in the Vatican. Cornwell cited all of his sources and interviewed many key figures, including Marcinkus, who denied all fraud allegations.
In another chapter, Cornwell talked to Don Diego Lorenzi, who was Pope John Paul I's Italian secretary. Lorenzi disputed Yallop's claim that Vatican security could be easily breached.
Plus, Lorenzi recalled the Pope didn't have any visitors the night he died. He said, quote, "There are only two entrances to the papal apartments, and they are guarded both day and night, unless, of course, someone managed to jump from St. Peter's Square straight into his bedroom."
As for the poisoning, Cornwell spoke to an impartial expert, vascular surgeon and Yale professor Dr. C. Francis Rowe, who didn't think it was possible. Rowe pointed out that if John Paul I ingested a toxin, well, there would be obvious evidence of the trauma.
However, when the staff found his body, it seemed as though he had died reading peacefully. Dr. Renato Buzzanetti, who theorized the Pope's leading cause of death, agreed. He didn't think it was remotely possible that the pontiff was poisoned. No one even alerted him that the Pope may have been in pain that night.
While Cornwell's book seemed to fully debunk Yallop's theory, the conspiracies lived on for over two decades.
28 years later, in 2017, the world received more concrete answers about Pope John Paul I's death. Cardinal Beniamino Stella and Italian journalist Stefania Falasca fought for the pontiff to become a saint. To add to her cause, she wrote a book called The September Pope, which examined the Holy Father's final days alive. Falasca dug up several official medical reports that all agreed the Pope died of a heart attack.
But when you're dealing with a secretive entity like the Vatican, can you really trust those records? Especially when it couldn't even determine who found Pope John Paul I's body.
I believe you can. To me, the facts are clear. Pope John Paul I died of natural causes, and sadly, it just so happened to be 33 days into his papacy. It was unfortunate timing, but we don't have proof that anyone tried to poison him or wanted him dead.
As of this recording, Pope John Paul I is in the process of canonization to achieve Catholic sainthood. There are three steps before he can be fully canonized. First, he must be considered venerable, then blessed, before becoming a saint.
Pope John Paul I posthumously achieved the first step in 2017.
5 years later, in 2022, the current Pope Francis moved his predecessor one step closer to sainthood, to the second stage, blessed.
In his sermon, the Holy Father focused on Pope John Paul I's humble, upbeat nature, pushing aside any wild conspiracies from the previous decades.
He said, quote, With a smile, Pope John Paul managed to communicate the goodness of the Lord. How beautiful is a church with a happy, serene, and smiling face that never closes doors, never hardens hearts, never complains or harbors resentments, isn't angry, does not look dour or suffer nostalgia for the past. Thanks for tuning in to Conspiracy Theories. You can find all episodes of Conspiracy Theories and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
We'll be back next time with a new episode.
Until then, remember, the truth isn't always the best story.
And the official story isn't always the truth.
Conspiracy Theories is a Spotify original from Parcast, executive produced by Max Cutler. Our head of programming is Julian Boireau. Our supervising sound designer is Russell Nash, with Nick Johnson as our head of production and quality control by Spencer Howard. Ryan O'Leary Jones is our supervising editor, and Derek Jennings is our writing lead. This episode of Conspiracy Theories was written by Mallory Cara, edited by Wendelin Sabroso and Lori Gottlieb, fact-checked by Kevin Johnson, researched by Bradley Klein, recorded by Freddie Rivera, produced by Bruce Katovich, and sound designed by Juan Borda. Our hosts are Molly Brandenburg and me, Carter Roy. Lack of evidence, poor police work, clever criminals. Whatever the reason, some murders remain unsolved.
Every Tuesday, Unsolved Murders explores the facts of a real-life cold case. Part dramatic podcast, part old-time radio show. Join the ensemble cast of actors as they take you on an exhilarating journey through the crime scene and its ensuing investigation.
Follow the Spotify original from Parcast, Unsolved Murders. Listen free only on Spotify.